All right, so our topic for today is understanding reproducibility and error correction in science. And I'd like to thank my co-organizer, Tom Kepler, who is here, who is a professor in the microbiology department here in the School of Medicine at BU. We worked together to put together this fabulous list of speakers for you today on this very important and timely topic, so we're glad you're here with us. We are going to have four speakers, each of which will have approximately an hour, and we'll pause after each talk for questions. So please feel free to come in at the end of the talk with your questions, and we'll have a chance to explore some of these issues. So our first speaker of the afternoon is Yuta Shikore. She is a professor in the Department of the History and Philosophy of Science and Medicine at Indiana University Bloomington. She received her PhD from the University of Hamburg, and she knows Boston well since she was a postdoc at the Dibner Institute when it was here at MIT across the river. Her research includes historical and philosophical debates about scientific methods, science and public engagement, science communication, and the problem of negative results and how to communicate them, as well as replication, which she'll be talking about today. She has several books, including The Microscope in the Eye, A History of Reflections, with University of Chicago Press. Another book, Going Amiss in Experimental Research, which was co-edited with Dora Hahn and Fritz Steinl, and more recently, Revisiting Discovery and Justification, The Concept and Distinction in Historical and Philosophical Perspective. She's also working on a new book, which she'll be sharing some of her research on that with us today. And her title is Repetition, Variation, and Control, Historical Perspectives. Please join me in welcoming Professor Shikore.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here. So my task for today is to open a historical perspective on replication and related matters. And I wanted to do so by discussing a few experimental works from the 17th and 18th centuries. And before I start doing that, I want to make some very brief remarks about the history of scientific methodologies. So what I wanted to do is to focus on what I call scientists' methods discourse. That is no reference to Foucault. I want to use that term to refer to all kinds of methods-related statements in scientific writings. So that includes explicit commitments to experimentalism, descriptions of procedures or methods, as well as justifications of methodological strategies. My history of methods discourse, so how scientists talking about these issues, strikes a balance between today's terminology and perspectives and past terminology and perspectives. You'll see that I'm making use of some current philosophical concepts, such as replication, and at the same time, I'm paying attention to the actor's own terms. The term replication is not a very common term in the 17th century. And another thing I want to do is also to pay attention to the ways in which past scientists discuss methodological issues. So where are they mentioned? Are they mentioned in introductions? Are they mentioned in experimental reports? Are they mentioned in textbooks? And most importantly, whether any reflections and justifications are offered on these methodological issues. So the idea is that if we find discussions of methodological notions, we can at least conclude that these discussions or that these issues were of concern for the scientists. So today, we are crucially interested in replication and related terms, and we are currently seeing a lot of discussion within the sciences as well as in the popular media about replication and the so-called replication crisis. Past scientists did replicate each other's works, but not very often, and they had also comparatively little to say about the nature and significance of replications. Their methodological discussions focus on other issues. The key concerns, as I want to show you in a moment, were repetitions of one's own work in the 17th century and repetitions with variations in the late 18th century. So I'm going to talk about snake venom research. And that might strike you as an odd topic, but for a number of reasons, that is quite suitable for the long-term study of what I want to do, namely look at how scientists discuss their methods. For over 250 years, researchers were interested in the same kinds of questions, namely the nature of venom and how it affects their animal bodies. And they approached the questions in similar ways, namely through animal experiments. And because experiments with poisonous snakes and venom were very taxing and tricky and often controversial, we have a lot of discussion about methods in these writings. And for that reason, it is quite interesting for the history of methods discourse. So in the following, I wanted to focus just on two periods, the mid-17th and the late 18th century. And I will look at the works of Francesco Redi in Italy, Moise Schwarz, who was a French naturalist and chemist, and Felice Fontana, again in Italy. I will briefly describe the projects, and so this is the characterization of the active ingredient in venom and its action on the body. And my focus will be on methodological issues. And more specifically, my focus is on comparative trials, controls, if you wish, repetitions and replications, or the lack thereof. And one more brief preliminary remark. You will see that many of these experiments that I will be describing were rather cruel. And the early modern experimenters very often pointed that out themselves, but they also justified these experiments because they thought they would lead eventually to greater knowledge about the functions of the body. In the following, I will not focus on these ethical concerns. There are other people who have done that. So I'm really focusing on the methodological issues, but the ethical concerns were there. Okay, let me start with a 17th century physician and naturalist in the court of the Grand Duke of Tuscany, Francesco Redi, who was a member of the Italian Academy of Science, and studied the nature and working of viper venom. And he wanted to advance 2 points. First, the yellow liquor, which is discharged from the viper's teeth, caused the fatal consequences of snake bites, as opposed to other parts of the snake. And secondly, the yellow fluid was innocent if you take it by mouth. It kills only when it was put in wounds. So these were the two things that he wanted to show. And he composed several letters to the secretary of the academy in which he stated his position and described a number of experiments to support them. In the opening and closing statements of these letters, Redi stated that he could not trust the phenomena if they are not confirmed by iterated and reiterated experience. So you have this commitment to experimentalism. And then throughout the letter, he stated repetitions of his own experiments. He noted that his experiments had been done multiple times. Old fables were refuted by experiments made many, many times. He had observed very often that the yellow liquor spurted into wounds when the viper struck. The effects of bile and of yellow fluid were tested on a number of different animals and repeatedly. And he had demonstrated the effects of venom taken from dead vipers in more than 100 experiments. So a lot of emphasis on these repetitions. We also find descriptions of comparative trials. For instance, he reported that he had punctured the thighs of 10 pigeons with broom straws sharpened like arrows and dipped in the yellow liquor collected from many dead vipers. The poison straws were left in the wounds. All pigeons died after 2 or 3 hours. He also wounded 4 other pigeons with straws that had not been dipped in the fluid, and these birds survived. The comparative experiment showed that it really was the yellow liquor that caused death, not the wound from the bite of the viper alone. Redi's French critic, the apothecary Moise Schwarz, utilized a very similar experimental strategy, this comparison, to advance a quite different idea. he thought it was not the yellow liquor, but in fact the rage of the viper that was caused death. So that seems a strange idea, but when you think of rabid dogs, for example, it seems less strange. So there is a theory by von Helmont behind this, but I don't want to talk about this theory. So Shiraz compared animals bitten by angry vipers and animals bitten by contented and relaxed vipers and demonstrated that only the first kind of bite caused death. I'm also not going to talk about Francis Bacon, but if you want to hear something about Bacon, ask me in the discussion. So, because Redi did these kinds of comparisons, he has been praised as the first to use experimental controls. I think this interpretation is misleading for a number of reasons. One is that for Redi himself, the novel and important point was that experiments must be repeated many times. So there are some classic models for these comparative experiments that he conducted. For example, Galen's treatise on theriac, which also is a work that compares animals that were treated differently. So this work contains the description of a drug test striking similar to the experimental arrangement in Redi's and Shiraz's works. In the relevant passage of Galen's treatise, it is described how poisonous beasts are placed among wild cocks that had received theriac, an antidote, and those who had not drunk theriac die immediately, but those who have drunk it are strong and stay alive after having been bitten. And another very well-known example is from the 14th century, that is, must have been known at least to Shiraz, and that is Bernard Gordon's investigation of theriac as an antidote to poison, which includes a comparison of a similar type. Gordon examined the efficacy of theriac proceeding just as Galen had, considering that there were prominent precedents of comparative experimentation. It is not surprising to find that neither Redi nor Shiraz commented much on the practice itself. But Redi did comment on justification, and on repetition, and he also provided justifications for repetitions. So, for example, I said at the beginning that we need to pay attention to the way in which experimenters discuss methodological issues, and I think for the issue of repetition and comparison, this is really quite striking. Because, as I said, we don't find much discussion of comparative experimentation as a strategy, but we do find several comments on why it is important to repeat experiments several times. So Redi criticized other people, for example, Severino, who is greatly experienced, he says, but he had been convinced by only two experiments that the yellow liquor was not lethal when it was put into wounds. So the implication is that is not enough. The reason is, Redi insisted that oftentimes it happens that genuine causes for some unknown or unseen hindrance cannot produce their effects. So there are certain accidents, certain contingencies that might get in the way and that make your experiments fail. And because of that possibility, you have to do it many, many times. And then he continues and describes several instances in which he had experienced that he did an experiment and for some reason it didn't quite work because accidents and contingencies, some of which he knew, some of which he didn't know, were interfering, and the experiment had not turned out as expected. Now, the interesting thing is that Shiraz also emphasized that it was important to perform many experiments to get a reliable result. And he even turned against Redi and said, well, at some point he was content with having made some of the yellow liquor to be swallowed by just one man, just one duck, just one kid, thence to know and to assure himself of its innocence when swallowed without making a greater number of experiments. So he criticizes Freely for not even doing enough of these repetitions. But when we look even more closely, we see that even these seemingly straightforward methodological statements like, oh, you just have to make many, many experiments, lent themselves to different interpretations at the time. Liddy and Sherrard, in fact, disagreed about the exact meaning of what it means to make many, many experiments. And one of Sherrard's experiments that Liddy criticized, a viper had been made to bite 5 pigeons, and all had died. When Reddy requested more trials, he surely meant that this entire experiment should be repeated many times. Sherrard took Reddy to mean that more pigeons should have been bitten by the same viper. And Sherrard did not see the point of that comment, because Reddy, after all, had found that the yellow liquor was exhausted after the first or second bite, so why should I, you know, continue to experiment with that snake? If this was the case, then it was indeed remarkable that the 5th pigeon still died. And Sherrard just pointed out that he had done more than enough to retain my reflection. So we have here this seemingly straightforward imperative that many, many experiments should be performed, which can mean at least 3 different things. Lots of experiments, meaning you have to investigate a topic from many different angles and just do lots of experiments on kind of the same theme. Many repetitions of the same trial, and then enough or even more than enough for a specific purpose. And I want you to keep that more than enough in mind, because I keep coming back to that. So hindsight tells us what kinds of these methodological concerns were deemed most important at the time and by the different investigators. We also see that some of the methodological imperatives and strategies that we take for granted were quite flexible and quite fluid at the time, when these modern experimentalists employed them. Even when they seem to agree about the importance of repetitions, when we look more closely, we still see that there's disagreement about how many repetitions were necessary, why they were necessary, and what exactly it meant to repeat an experiment many times. I noted that replication, in the sense of reproducing other people's experiments, were not much of an issue. Only rarely did researchers explicitly refer to the replication of experiments, and when they did so, they called it imitation of another investigator's work. But the discussion is not really about replication in our sense of the term. Rather, what we see here is a negotiation of proper procedure. The experiments on the therapeutic effects of viper meat, for example, is a good case to illustrate that. Sherrard's experiments showed that swallowing viper heads was an effective treatment of snake bite. He reported that an animal bitten by a viper had been cured by eating the head of another viper. Now, Reddy reported that he had fed viper heads to 2 dogs. One head was half cooked, the other was crushed in a mortar, as per Sherrard's description, so he tried to do the same procedure. And both dogs were subsequently bitten in the ear, and both survived. So that looks like a successful imitation of Sherrard's procedure. But it did not confirm what Reddy was thinking about snakes and the working of venom. So a doubt arose, as he put it, and he repeated the experiments without feeding the dogs viper meat, and both dogs survived, having bitten in the ear. So then he proceeded to feed viper heads to other animals that were bitten by snakes, including cocks, dogs, kittens, hares, and so on. And all animals died from snake bites, but they were bitten in the thigh or in the tongue, not in the ear. So it is a different, it's a variation in the procedure. And what is interesting is that Reddy emphasized that he did more than Shiraz. In some trials, the place of the bite had not only been, had also been smeared with viper blood as an additional antidote. So he not only fed them the viper meat, but they did more, they also inserted viper blood into the wound. Shiraz, in turn, cast doubt on Redi's conclusions and pointed out that Redi's first results had agreed with the, had agreed with the evidence obtained by himself, because dogs that had swallowed viper's heads after having been bitten had survived the bite. And he did not accept the other experiments as proper replications. The other experiments had diverged too far from the original design. Shiraz had used medium-sized dogs and really large ones on which, he said, no certain judgment could be made. And then he proceeded to present another kind of evidence, namely a case history, which was, again, in his favor. A young man who had bitten, who had been present at Shiraz's experiments was bitten by a viper while trying to hold it. Shiraz reported that the young man had so much faith in the truth contained in Shiraz's book that he immediately decided to eat the head and neck of a viper. Shiraz served up the broiled head, neck, heart, and liver of the viper. So again, he did more so, and he did even more, namely he made the young man swallow some volatile salt of the viper. And the man, surprisingly, recovered nicely, even though this wound had been really very deep, as it was also pointed out. So, one last... Shiraz's group also imitated Redi's experiments with the yellow liquor, and failed to obtain the results that the Italians had obtained. Like Redi, Shiraz gave yellow fluid to the pigeons and two kittens, and he did more. Again, he said so. He made a point of engaging a person whom he knew most favorable to Redi to make the incision, and he observed that this gentleman severed the animal so much that that Shiraz could not hold to tell him, smiling, he did more than Signor Redi himself said in his letters he had done. And none of the animals died. And all pigeons and pullets wounded with freshly cut heads of wipers survived, even though Shiraz had proceeded by thrusting the teeth into them as deep as he could. So again, he did more when he was trying to repeat this experiment. As the evidence of this experiment clearly showed that Redi was wrong, Shiraz was unable to comprehend why Redi's animals had died after the application of yellow liquor to wounds. So we have quite different strategies related to imitation. Typically, imitation is explicitly discussed when something is not working, either when different results are obtained or when results obtained do not fit one's own theory. The researcher who does the unsuccessful replication typically claims that his experiment yields the correct results. The other researcher's experiment has a flawed design or some unknown factor interfered. And to make the point more forcefully, the critics stress that by imitating, they are not doing the exact same things, but they are doing more in some sense. So they are using more venom, they are making a bigger wound, and so on. So that is quite, actually, I only started paying attention to that when I was preparing for that talk. That was the first time that I actually noted that this is a really a recurrent thing that you find in these exchanges. They are insisting that they are doing more when they are repeating. How much time do I have?
You have about 20 minutes.
Okay. I wanted to talk a little about the 18th century. So I'm proceeding now to Fontana. was a late 18th century naturalist physician in the same position that Redi had about 100 years earlier, a naturalist at the Tuscan court, who published a two-volume account of experiment on the composition and working of viper venom and other poisons and a commonly used antidotes. His main aim was to confirm Redi's point, so that it is indeed the yellow fluid flowing from the viper's teeth that caused death, and that the main effect of this fluid is on the blood of the viper victim, and he also wanted to show that volatile alkali is not effective as an antidote. That is ammonia. Fontana's descriptions of his experiments include numerous remarks on methodological issues. But what is also interesting about that book, that long two-volume book, is that it contains a methodological essay where Fontana expounds principal methods of successful experimentation. These are the three that he proposes. The first is to multiply the experiments exceedingly. The second is to vary them in a thousand ways, changing the circumstances as the nature and species of them may require, and giving them all the precision and simplicity they are capable of. And the third method is not only to succeed in making experiments, but likewise to attain to a discovery of the sources of errors that others have fallen into. So note, comparative trials, comparative experimentation is again not one of the principles. And from these, the third principle perhaps resonates most with our present day intuitions about replication. But Fontana's emphasis throughout the volume is on the second principle. So the first principle echoes the early modern views that experiments must be repeated many, many times. And in fact, Fontana took this experiment, took this requirement to the extreme. He repeatedly claimed that he had used more than 3,000 vipers and more than 4,000 other animals in a total of over 6,000 experiments, and many of them were repeated hundreds of times, as he says. But as I said, his emphasis on the second principle, so the emphasis is really on variations or what he calls diversification of experiments. And he emphasized that again and again, not only in the methodological essay, but throughout the text. So for example, the very first chapter of that volume, it's right after the methodological essay, and it's entitled Whether the Volatile Alkali is a Certain Remedy Against the Bite of the Viper. And the first sentence of that chapter reads, I deemed it necessary to examine this first question in the most circumstantial way, and therefore multiplied the experiments extremely and diversified them very much. So he reiterates his principles. This is the only method that could lead to demonstration, and I flatter myself that my readers will be freed from all doubt. So by focusing on variation, Fontana demanded that circumstances surrounding experimental trials be examined. And that is really a big change from what we see in the late mid to late 17th century. I mentioned earlier the accidents and the contingencies that Redi was concerned about, and that he said we have to repeat our stuff many, many times to exclude contingencies and accidents of having an impact on our experiments. What we find here is something different. Fontana explicitly required that the circumstances of experimentation be investigated and assessed. He was optimistic that through multiple variation of experimental settings, the circumstances surrounding and impinging on experiments could be identified, and he described all the variations that he did to his readers. So here's an example of that. The first series of experiments from this chapter on the volatile alkali concerns the effects of volatile alkali on sparrows and pigeons that have been bitten by snakes. And here is just, it's part of a passage from that chapter. It just gives you a flavor of the the reports that we find there. So I had a pigeon bit in the leg by a viper and instantly treated the part. At the end of a minute, it fell forward and could not longer support itself. In 20 seconds more, it died. I had another pigeon like the first bit in the same way, but I did not treat it. At the end of 2 minutes, it fell forward, and in 2 minutes more, it died, and so on. So it's really, this is, as I said, it's a part of the passage. There are a lot more of these kinds of experiments, and the book is full of it. So it's 700 pages like that, and I read them all. So there are several things that are really noteworthy about this. This is not only the verbose style of writing, it's also the repetitions, both the ones that are described and the repetitive phrases, and the presence of numbers, and the fact that groups of birds were compared. So all that is typical, and you find it all over the book. And you will not be surprised to hear that Fontana was also praised as the first to use controls. Even as late as 1962, herpetologists have described him as the first of the great experimentalists to use adequate controls. And we can see why, the comparisons of the treated and the untreated birds. But when we read on, we find that Fontana really highlighted the diversification and the variation, not the comparison. So it did seem clear that the volatile alkali did not prevent death, but as the numbers show, the numbers that I'm quoted in the passage, show that the time of death really varied extremely. So much so that Fontana says a reasonable conjecture seemed impossible. The treated birds sometimes died after 40 hours and sometimes after a few minutes. And Fontana reiterated this methodological principle: experiments must be multiplied and the circumstances attending them examined most attentively. And then what he described, an infinite number of experiments diversified in every possible way and in which all the circumstances that accompanied them were rigorously examined. And then after that, he proceeds to describe all these things that he did. And then in the end, he established that a range of circumstances might have an influence on the experimental outcomes. So, the size of the viper, the force of the bite, the amount of venom, the depth of the wound, there's some variation in how much venom is in the viper's teeth, and so on. And what he then did is he changed the design of the experiment in such a way, and this is really unpleasant. So he cut off the head of the viper and then induced the venom manually. And in this way, he could control the force of the bite, the place of the bite, and all that. And by doing that, he ended up with experiments that yielded a lot more uniform results. So first we had the 40 hours and the 8 minutes, and in the end he ends up with experiments that where the animals all die, the smaller animals between 5 and 8 minutes, and the bigger animals, bigger birds, between 8 and 12 minutes. As in the 17th century, we find a very little discussion about redoing other people's experiments. Recall that this was the third principle, the discovery of the sources of errors that others have fallen into. But there's a little explicit discussion about this and few examples of other people's errors. There's one of the few, is this one. This is the discussion of the early 18th century physician Richard Mead, who had observed sharp crystals in viper venom, which Fontana couldn't find, even though he looked very carefully. So he did that with a microscope. And he kind of indicated that Mead was really incompetent as an observer. He may have looked at some bodies floating in saliva and mistaken them for salts, Which Fontana says is a mistake easily made by those who don't know how to do microscopic observations. But then he proceeds to say, to show that his own observations were correct. So he emphasizes he has looked carefully, he has varied the instruments, he used an English lens and a solar microscope, but he still has been unable to see any crystals in the venom. And then he does something else, namely, he mentions two additional experiments. He wants to make the issue more certain by doing something slightly different to investigate what Mead has investigated, namely he watched a drop of venom drying under his microscope. He must have had incredible patience. And then he saw how it cracked and fragmented while it was drying, and that was his other evidence for the fact that he thought that Mead's observation were in error. So he repeated that several times, both with pure venom and with drops of venom, but he could never find these salts. Okay, I'm coming to my conclusion. I just wanted to reiterate some of the key points about repetition, replication, variation, and control. So what I've done is, on the one hand, I've taken some present-day conceptions and distinctions, such as replication, the distinction between reproduction of effects and reproduction redoing procedures, and so on, to reconstruct these procedures. And I mean, without having these conceptions in mind, I think I would not have been able to make a whole lot of sense of these experimental strategies. On the other hand, I've also tried to both pay attention to the concepts that the past scientists were using, namely imitation, for example, and the way in which they described their strategies, and the question of whether they provide justifications for their strategies and actually kind of highlight them as strategies. And I mean, this is particularly interesting, I think, with regard to the issue of repetition and with regard to the issue of comparative trials, because all these people do comparative trials, but they don't talk about this as a strategy. They talk about repetitions, they talk about variations, but they don't talk about comparative trials, even though when we look back, we can see them comparing all the time. It was just, you know, that was a standard procedure, but it was not presented as something that is noteworthy. So here's kind of my summary slide with regard to the similarities and differences between the two 18th century and the the two 17th century and the 18th century people. And you see, so they all describe the comparative trials, but they focused their attention there, when they talked about methodological issues, they focused their attention on something different, on repetitions, just on many experiments, and on variations and identifying circumstances. And then the other thing that I think is noteworthy is the way in which accidents and circumstances are treated, because that shows us that really the conception of nature and regularities in nature really also changes between the late 17th and the late 18th century quite considerably. Since this is on replication, I also wanted to draw out some issues that might be related for our discussion later in this afternoon, namely what exactly can we find in terms of reproducing other people's works. As I said, there's not much that's actually done, at least, of course, this is all related to the materials that I've investigated, so I can only really speak for those people. There's not a lot of discussion of redoing other people's experiments. There's not much explicit discussion about the potential issues that one may encounter. And if it was done, there were quite different approaches. It's really hard even to systematize how people went about doing other people's, redoing other people's experiments. So some redid the same procedure, and then when it was unsuccessful, it was, you know, the original experiment is deemed flawed, or it was the wrong experiment for the purpose. But the other thing that I emphasized several times is that strange emphasis on, well, I did it, but I did more of it. I did, used more material, I cut the wounds deeper, and so on. And the last thing the more of it can also mean just providing other types, so in a sense a variety of evidence, other kinds of evidence that also make the point. And I don't know if we want to go so far as to call this replicating an effect. I think that would be perhaps a misrepresentation of the material, but that is maybe something we might want to discuss. But it's definitely the emphasis is on, okay, I have something else that shows something that's related, and this shows that my approach and my findings are actually the correct ones. Okay, I will leave it at that. Thank you very much.